New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring after-death communication with my guest, Matthew McKay, who has been a clinical psychologist for 40 years and professor of psychology at the Wright Institute. He has authored and co-authored over 40 books, including Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, Jordan's Message to the Living on What to Expect After Death, Love in the Time of Impermanence, and Lessons from the Afterlife, a Deep Knowledge Meditation Guidebook. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. This is a second interview with Matthew on New Thinking Aloud, and he is joining us from Berkeley, California. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Matt. It is a joy to have you back with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
I'm glad to be with you, Em.
In our first conversation, we talked about love and impermanence, and I'll link to that interview in the right upper corner of the screen. In that interview, you talked about how you are able to continue the bond of love with your son, Jordan, and how we all can do this, and that death really doesn't stop our connection with our loved ones in the afterlife. Today, we're going to explore more about your communication with your son, Jordan. Can you share a little bit with us about your son, Jordan, and how you were able to begin communicating with him after his death?
Yes, Jordan has been gone from the physical place that we call Earth for over 15 years. And almost from the moment I knew he died, I was obsessed with trying to find him, trying to see if I could connect to him. And I think I felt what anyone feels who's lost someone they love dearly is, you know, is that soul still exist? And is that person, that soul, okay? Are they okay where they are? And those were just burning questions to me. And I started out trying to, you know, seek the answer with mediums. I worked with Felix Lerman, San Francisco, Austin Wells. And then I went to visit Alan Botkin, who was the discoverer of something called IADC, Induced After-Death Communication, that uses EMDR as sort of the base for launching into the ability to talk to others on the other side. And I had the experience with Botkin of actually hearing Jordan. He showed up. He was there. I heard him, and he said the things that I needed to hear, which is that, you know, he's with us, he loves us, he's really good where he is. And so that was, you know, and some of the grief lifted, and I began to feel some hope that I could reach him and had reached him on some level, except it wasn't a conversation. It wasn't an opportunity to really talk back and forth and explore something together. It was a one-way communication. And so I consulted Ralph Messner, who was a specialist in the afterlife, in learning about it and communicating with souls in the afterlife. And he taught me how to channel. And now I don't have any, you know, special abilities. I'm not clairaudient. I don't have mediumship type abilities. But I've learned that anyone can channel, and I learned within an hour. He taught me in about an hour. I went home and I had my first experience of actually having a conversation with Jordan, hearing from him, and being able to ask questions and learn as almost as much as I could hold. And so that was the beginning. And, you know, we've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of conversations in the last 15 years. And, you know, Jordan has initiated writing a number of books. He has things that he wants to say to incarnate souls here on earth. And he has found a way to say them through me. But he's also continues to support me and help me and advise me. And in addition to these projects of these books that he wants others to know about.
What are some of the messages that Jordan shares with you?
One of the things that is really most important to me, and I think to the people who are following Jordan, learning from him, is, you know, the purpose of life. You know, why do we come here? It's a difficult place. There's lots of struggle. There's lots of pain here. So why do souls incarnate here? What's the point? And I think sometimes we have this sense that, you know, there's so much pain and it's a sign of failure that, I mean, when we struggle and when we hurt and when we have losses, that somehow it's our fault, it's our failure. And Jordan says it's just the opposite. We come here to learn. We come here to grow and evolve as souls. And because as souls, we're part of God, we're part of all of the divine. We are God, all of us together. And because we come here to learn, we are helping God or the divine or all evolve as well. So God isn't like this perfect puppet master that's just, you know, running everything and watching us struggle here for his pleasure. God is evolving and God is growing. And we as individual pieces of consciousness, as parts of God, are helping him grow and evolve as we grow and evolve on earth. So we have a sacred mission here. It's not just, you know, show up and have this life. It's show up and learn how to love in the face of all the pain and struggle on this planet. And in learning how to love, we evolve and grow and the divine evolves and grows.
In your latest book, you share these channeled messages from Jordan, and then you also give journal prompts for people to explore within themselves. So it's an opportunity to go within. And some of the topics that you share, which you just touched upon, some of them are the mysteries of human existence, what the divine or God is, the nature of the soul, why we experience beauty and pain, the nature of matter and energy, and the origin of the universe, time and impermanence, and discerning reality, illusion versus meaning. Before we get into some more of these topics and what Jordan has shared with you about these, what do you say when people either question, or did you ever question yourself, the veracity of these messages and whether you were just making these up in your own sense of loss or grief?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, first of all, I want to say that anyone who channels, who you know, tries to connect to those on the other side, is going to have some doubt. Doubt is, it goes with this. There thoughts arise, you know, is this my experience, or is this really coming from my loved one? And so I just want to acknowledge that doubt is kind of inescapable. And Jordan has told me that I'm not going to be able to somehow arrive at a place where the doubt ceases to exist, it ceases to be part of the experience. But I can tell you what helps me feel a strong degree of hope and expectation that Jordan is there and talking to me. One is that he talks in his own way. He doesn't communicate in the style that I communicate. So it feels very different. His choice of language, the way he constructs language, and a sentence is different. And then the other thing that really is, for me, the most profound is that he has said so many things to me that I didn't know and I had no awareness of, that completely blew me away. Like, where is that? Where did that come from? And it came from a soul who has incredible amount of wisdom and knowledge on the other side, knowledge that I don't have. And so over and over and over again, he surprised me and kind of exploded my mind in some ways with the things he says. And this happens and continues to happen. And every time it happens, I have this sense of awe of being in the presence of not just my son, who I knew so well and loved so much, but in the presence of a soul who has a vast amount of experience and knowledge, who's lived hundreds of lives and has access to all of the knowledge and awareness from those lives, as well as the access to the spirit world and all that we get exposed to there. So it's an interesting and wonderful and humbling experience to hear things over and over again that surprise and amaze me. And that's another way that it's helped me feel more confident, because I keep discovering things I had no knowledge of.
What has surprised you that Jordan has shared with you?
I think one of the things that he's said in different ways is that, you know, in some ways religion kind of fails us. We're trying to join together in these religious groups. It's a tribe, essentially. But the problem is that there's the people that are in the tribe and the people who are out of the tribe. And so there's this judgment inherent. You know, there's the people who are good or have been saved, who are on the path of righteousness, whatever it is, whatever the religion, how the religion describes its tenets and beliefs. There are people who are cast out, who don't belong, and they become on some level subhuman. And I don't think this is true of every religion, but religions tend to be exclusionary. They're, you know, either you're in or you're out, and you either believe in a whole set of dogmatic set of beliefs, or you're somehow an apostate, a person who's, you know, who doesn't belong. And Jordan is saying, you know, that's really not what spirituality is. And like, spirituality is learning how we are connected to all and feeling the love and connection to all, as opposed to excluding and judging. It's including and loving and everyone, regardless of where they are in space and time, whether they're living or dead, and what particular beliefs they may hold, loving everyone. And so the message is inclusion rather than tribal. And I think that's one of the more dramatic things that Jordan has said, and that spirituality is not about judgment. It's not about good and bad, not about right and wrong. Spirituality is about discovering how to love in the face of all the struggle and pain we encounter on this planet. That's what spirituality is, learning how to love in the face of pain. And he's just emphasized that over and over and over again. And the importance of moving beyond tribe toward oneness.
How has your ability to communicate with Jordan impacted your life personally?
In lots of ways. One way is I'm very much less afraid of death. I mean, as a younger person, I was terrified of death. And the prospect of death, the specter of death, was always with me. And over the years, I've written a lot of poetry, published a lot of poetry, and a lot of my poetry is about death and anticipating it and wondering about it and trying to make sense of it. And so that is sort of part of my history, and that changed because Jordan has told me so clearly what's on the other side. And he did encourage us to write a book called The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife that describes what really happens on the other side, and also how to prepare for one's transition, how to prepare for moving from the physical plane to the spirit world. So he really has offered that to me. And that's changed me profoundly. And the other thing is I feel less alone. I feel like he's with me all the time. Mm-hmm. And he's guiding me, supporting me, and reminding me that he's there in lots of different ways. And the feeling his support from the other side has made a big difference in my life. And also he's guided me to do things and to not do things. And it's not uncommon for him to show up and say, don't say that, or don't do that. Right, just boom, he just right. And oftentimes he helps me with clients. I'm working with a client and I'm stumped and I don't know what to do. And he jumps in and says, try this. Mm-hmm. So he's with me all the time, mm-hmm. supporting me in lots of different ways. And it's just made an enormous difference in my life not to be isolated inside my body, inside my history and my experience, but to have him present whenever I need or seek him.
That sounds so beautiful. I think there are many people listening who would love to continue that relationship with their loved one in the afterlife. And some people think that the normal grieving process is to simply let them go.
Yeah, I think it's just the opposite. And Jordan has made it so clear to me that love continues without interruption, without any blockage, actually, after death, that the love is as strong and that we can manifest it, we can experience it, and all we have to do is really think about the one we love on the other side. They are just a thought away. Thinking about them, being aware of them, opens the channel. And of course, we don't usually realize that. We just think about them and just feel, love or sadness or missing or something. But we don't realize that actually thinking about them is opening the channel, and we could begin a communication. And that's something that he's made very, very clear to me. And Ralph taught me that too when he taught me about channeling. He said, all the people on the other side that we love are just a thought away. And all we have to do is direct our attention in a receptive way, ask questions, and we will get answers. Mm-hmm. And that's turned out to be very true. And I've taught hundreds of people how to channel, and almost all of them have been able to do it and have received communications that have meant a lot to them. And I work a lot with people who are in a state of grief. And when they learn how to channel, they learn the most profound thing, which is that they didn't lose that person. And that the love that always was between them continues between them. And they can tap into it anytime they want. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's made a big difference in my life. And it has enabled me to help people who are struggling with grief. So rather than, give up, that person's gone, and just I have to go through a process of letting them go. No, it's going through a process of reaching out to them and finding a way to connect across the curtain.
How has that impacted your clients who you work with when you have guided them to connect with their loved ones? How has it ameliorated or alleviated their grief?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is I'm a psychotherapist, and I specialize in treating trauma, including traumatic loss and death. And I learned how to do Alan Botkin's technique of induced after-death communication, because I use EMDR all the time. And EMDR is a standard treatment for traumatic loss. But the variation on the process that he introduced, I do. I'm not as successful as he is. Happens with about 50% of my clients as opposed to 90% like with Alan. But when my clients have the experience of actually making contact with their loved one, and I've seen it again and again, that they can actually feel the person holding them. In many cases, they see the person, and in all cases, they can hear the person. And the grief changes profoundly because they experience that person is still there, that loved one is still there. And usually they say very important things. The loved one will say very important things, that they're with them, that they love them, they support them, the relationship, it goes on. I mean, they're saying things that my client really needs to hear. So that's one thing. And when that occurs, it's just profound, and it's very, very beautiful. And I feel I can't tell you how privileged I feel and how grateful I feel to be able to witness that. Mm-hmm. But also, I do teach clients to channel, which in some ways can be more valuable because now there's a real conversation, and you can ask questions, and you learn to your loved one says something interesting or important, and you can ask, well, what does that mean? Or tell me more about that. Or I don't understand what, and so there's a real conversation, and in the conversation, they can discover things about their relationship. You know, like why did that loved one leave at this point? And then oftentimes there's still work that they're doing in the relationship, and they're understanding each other, trying to make sense of things that happened in life. And they can continue to do that work through channeled communication. And so that's a very beautiful thing. So that the relationship, not only is the relationship not over, not only is the love active and continuing, but some of the learning processes that were part of the relationship can continue as they continue to talk to each other.
How is the receptivity to this process among your psychologist and psychotherapy colleagues?
Well, it's mixed. I'm a psychologist, but I'm also a researcher. I've done a lot of randomized controlled trials. I've developed 5 different kinds of therapies over the years that were evidence-based. And so, you know, I'm pretty committed to science, and a lot of the people that I know and have worked with have similar commitments to science and research. And so some of those folks are very uncomfortable with channeling. And, you know, one researcher that I know in particular who just can't even talk about it. It's just like, you know, it's crazy, and we won't go near it. Was very upset when he found out that I engage in channeling and written books about it and so forth. On the other hand, there are people who I've worked with who have a deep spiritual quest that they've been on, and channeling has been an opportunity for them to deepen their spirituality, and they've seized on it, and it's meant a lot to them. And so I think it's how open a person is to the possibility that life continues after death, how open they are to how much they desire to maintain that connection to people on the other side after death. So it really depends on that. And so there have been a lot of mixed results. You know, some people in my field have been incredibly receptive and in fact have endorsed some of the books. And other people just, you know, it smells of insanity to them, and they don't want to go near it.
And yet it helps many people.
Yeah, it helps many people. And the people that reject it say, yeah, well, maybe it helps people, but that doesn't mean it's true. There are a lot of, you know, crazy ideas that sometimes can be helpful, even though they're not true. I mean, for example, you know, Freud's idea that there's an ego, superego, and id. Well, those things don't exist. But sometimes that organizing reality to include some of those ideas can be helpful to people or useful. And you know, there are a lot of ideas in psychology that are not necessarily true, but can offer people ways of changing their lives. Like, you know, I do kind of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy. And one of the tenets of acceptance and commitment therapy is you have no control over your thoughts or your emotions. And that's a useful concept because the whole idea is to accept the thoughts and emotions and learn to accept what shows up. But it's not true. We do have a certain amount of control over our thoughts and our emotions. And so while it's a useful concept and a useful idea, and gives people, it teaches them and moves them in the direction of acceptance, it's not necessarily the absolute truth. So I'm just, you know, that's an example of ideas we have in psychology that can be useful without being absolutely the case.
Earlier, you mentioned that Jordan shared about what the afterlife is like. Can you give us a little insight into what he shared with you about that? I know you've written a whole book on it.
He has been so open about that. And I think the reason, from his point of view, was to help me get over my fear of death, and or lessen it a great deal. And so he describes something called the landing place, which is just adjacent to the spirit world. And in the landing place, we are kind of getting used to being without a body, and seeing in 360 degrees instead of just seeing straight ahead, and communicating telepathically as opposed through sound. And so in the landing place, it's a place of adjustment. And the other thing is, once we leave our bodies, when we have an image, a picture in our mind, it can actually project outwards and energetically, and we can actually see it. And Jordan described, you know, when he got to the landing place, he was kind of disoriented, and he just, you know, started, you know, he actually started thinking about Yosemite, tried to think of something peaceful, and then suddenly he could see the images of Yosemite in front of him. And then somehow the idea came to his mind of an elephant. Now suddenly he has an elephant in Yosemite standing in front of him. And he starts to realize that whatever he's thinking about or imaging projects outward as an energy form. And that it can, and so if we arrive there and we're full of fear, we're projecting scary images, and we have to kind of learn how not to do that. And so in the landing place, we're just getting used to this experience of being energy as opposed to being a physical body, and what that means in terms of how we see and understand things and how we communicate. Adjacent also to the landing place are bardas, where souls can recover, who are in a lot of pain, who are carrying intense energy and painful, disturbing emotions. Those can't enter the spirit world. So there are bardas where that can get worked through, and there are healers who help souls with damaged energy, recover and then get, you know, be able to move into the spirit world. So the landing place and some of these adjacent bardas are all about getting used to not living in a body anymore, and dealing with whatever residual emotions and fears and experiences that we're carrying that we need to process before getting in the spirit world. So once we get into the spirit world, pretty much almost immediately, and a lot of people have talked about this in near-death experiences, we go into life review and a period of evaluation. And lots of souls have described this, and you know, the images they use are somewhat different, but the experience is the same. It's a deep meditation, and they're held and guided by guides, by souls who are there to protect and support them in the process. And this review goes on for quite a while because it involves examining every single thing we've done in our life. Every single decision, not like big decisions, like what will my career be or where should I live, but all day long there are decisions we're making about how we interact with others and whether we bring love or something else to these encounters and relationships. And so these decisions are going on. So we review all of that, and we review it in a number of ways. One is the experience of the soul, but also we experience the other person as they experienced our choice and our behavior. And not only do we experience it as they experienced it at that moment when we did what we did, but we can experience how it affected them over time. So, for example, a father who's remembering slapping his son is not only aware of, you know, his experience at that moment, he can feel what that slap meant and felt like to his son, but he can also feel how that slap has touched and affected his son over years. And all of that is happening during the review process. It's a fascinating process. It's very arduous. Sometimes it's very beautiful because we get to see things that, you know, we can appreciate and celebrate about our lives and our choices. But it also is looking at, and it's also looking at it without judgment. It's not you're good or you're bad. You were learning. Everything you did, every choice you made was part of your learning and why you come to this planet. So it's not like you failed because sometimes you made choices that caused pain. It's that you were learning. Everything you did, you learn, and you're learning in the process of review as well. After the review process, souls typically matriculate back with their soul group, and they return to the group. And the groups are anywhere from usually, 6, 8 to 20 souls. And you can think of a soul group as like a family. And the soul group, continues, through countless lifetimes, each of them incarnating and coming back to the soul group, sharing what they've learned. And a soul group is sort of like a little classroom in which there's a lot of learning that takes place, and there are guides that help each soul group. And each soul group is a family. And then they live in a neighborhood of adjacent soul groups, in other houses and on nearby blocks and so forth. And so one soul group will often be very well connected to other adjacent soul groups. And then also we are connected to sometimes souls that are far away, spatially in the afterworld, afterlife. But we come to love them because of a particular life we shared. So we have lots of souls that are nearby that we're close to, that we incarnate with. And then we have some souls that are more distant that we've come to love because we went through an important incarnation together. Souls do incarnate together from a soul group and nearby groups. And they're like a little repertory company where they show up in about the same time and place. And then they have different relationships. In one particular life or play, you might be a partner, a romantic partner with somebody. In another play, they might be a brother or a friend, or maybe even an antagonist. And, I have somebody in my soul group who's shown up in several of my lives, including this one, as an antagonist. And Jordan has shown up in different lives in different roles. In a fairly recent life, he was my wife, as opposed to my sons, in a different gender and a very profoundly different relation. In another life, he was an unrequited love. In another life, he was a guide. We were in yeshiva together, and he was an old rabbi. Each of these lives are like little plays that we enter, and we have different roles in the plays. And it's really very beautiful. And we share so much, not just in one life, but over many lives with our soul group and nearby souls.
How are you able to continue to communicate with him if he is having reincarnations?
There's the concept called Atman and Jiva that when the soul incarnates, it divides its energy. Some of the energy always remains in the spirit world. And some of the energy then enters a physical body. Part of the soul that enters the physical body goes through a forgetting process. It goes through amnesia so that we can take this thing seriously. If we didn't have amnesia and didn't forget about all of our past lives and all of our knowledge in the afterlife, we wouldn't take it very seriously. It's like, oh yeah, this happened, but it's no big deal, because I'm not taking this life very seriously. So we have to have amnesia in order to believe that this life is important and is special, and to feel the risks that seem to exist in our lives. In order to really feel those risks and respond to them, we have to believe this is the only life. But meanwhile, there's energy that remains in the afterlife. So Jordan is already incarnated. He's a early teen, a woman, a girl, a single mom is taking care of him. And in that life, he has no memory of being Jordan or of our life together or of the spirit world. But the part of Jordan's energy that remains in spirit is always available for me to communicate with. And that's true of anybody that you love at any given time. They might not be incarnating and all of their energy is there in spirit world, but very often they are incarnating And so their energy is divided, but nothing prevents you from communicating to them in spirit. In fact, nothing prevents you from communicating to your own soul in spirit that has a lot of wisdom and knowledge. And so you can do something called a deep knowledge meditation and communicate essentially to your own higher self. So you can, you know, when you're channeling, you can channel your own higher self. You can channel loved ones. You can channel guides. So you have choices in terms of your address. What address are you sending your questions and communications to? And you can also channel the divine, although the outcome of those communications are sometimes different from when you're channeling as somebody who's a soul. The knowledge shows up from the divine differently. It shows up as awareness as opposed to words and language usually.
Mm-hmm.
Channeling isn't limited to one soul on the other side. It's something that you can decide on the address. You can channel to somebody, to guides. You can channel to any number of souls that you know or care for. And you can channel to your own higher self. So you have some choices to who you talk to.
What do you say to folks who may be listening and thinking, well, you just need to let them be and let them continue on in the afterlife, and by staying in communication, you're somehow affecting their ability to move forward?
Yeah, that's completely, according to Jordan anyway, that's not true. Souls in the afterlife have the capacity to focus on multiple things at once. They're not like us. They're not limited in the human brain where they can only focus straight ahead on, you know, what's in front of me right here. Souls in the afterlife could be doing five or six different things at once. They could be essentially in a classroom, not literally a classroom, but in a process of learning something with a guide. They could also be reviewing the Akashic record and looking at different choices they made and seeing, you know, what would have happened if I did X instead of Y. They could be exploring that. They could be actually doing spiritual tourism. They could be visiting a different planet and observing what goes on there. They could be studying the history of the universe. They could be merging with all, which we do periodically. In the afterlife, we do spend usually fairly short periods of time merging with all and kind of absorbing knowledge very, very quickly, very deeply. And they can be hanging out with people that they love and observing and supporting them on Earth. They can be doing all of that at once because they can divide their attention in amazing ways. So we're not limiting them or preventing them from growing and evolving because we continue to talk to them. In fact, it's just the opposite. When we give them love, they feel it. It's a meaningful experience to those who are on the other side. Our love touches them. They take it in. And so when we communicate with them, when we think about them, when we think of them with love, they're getting something that's beautiful and positive. So it's the exact opposite of using them or deflecting or somehow helping them distract from their purpose and their work in the afterlife. It's exact opposite. What is our work? Our work is to love. And when they spend time connecting with us through love, that's exactly what they're doing. They're loving, and that's what we do in the afterlife. We love.
Mm-hmm.
So they're fulfilling their purpose.
And what we're learning to do here as well.
And that's what we're learning to do here as well. That's the whole point of becoming a soul, is learning how to love. And in learning how to love, everything we learn is uploaded to all and becomes part of all's evolution. You can think of it like, you know, souls are all in the afterlife or in the spirit world. We all live in a hive. And we go out of the hive like bees, and we go out and collect nectar. What we're collecting is experience, knowledge, and wisdom. And we're learning. So that's what, and then we bring that back to the hive. And so basically, we're we're supporting and nurturing the hive and the growth and development of the hive by each trip into incarnated life and all that we learn there and bring it back.
If we are all divine and we are really love, why is it so hard for us to always be loving?
Well, that's something that really has been maybe one of the most important things Jordan has conveyed to me anyway. So he says, look, in the afterlife or in the spirit world, love is what connects everybody. And it's effortless on some level. Souls can merge with each other and feel, you know, very deep experiences of love and connection. Souls can merge with all, with the divine, and feel deep sense of love and connection. And love is the gravity that holds everything together, that holds all of consciousness together. And again, it's effortless. It's the air we breathe in the spirit world. However, love that is unearned, that's effortless, we don't really know how to create it. And we come to Earth to learn how to create it in the face of all the difficulties and struggles and pain that exists on a physical plane. Let me get a silly example. Okay, so let's say a mom has had a very difficult day at work. Something happened where she feels very anxious about what's going on with her job. She's also very tired, depleted, arrives home, and her kid is in the middle of a very difficult homework experience and also had a bad day at school and needs a lot of support and nourishment. Okay, this is what, see, love here requires the mom somehow deal with her tiredness, deal with her anxiety, and still fully commit to and intend to support and care for her child in this moment that the child needs. And you can't learn that love in the afterlife because there's no friction. There's nothing getting in the way. There's no pain. So part of what makes this such a sacred mission here is learning how to love with all of the obstacles, all the pain, with that tiredness, with that, you know, or let's, another example, let's say you're, you know, in a relationship with a partner and the partner has said something really critical about you. And suddenly there's this overwhelming sense of shame, this sense that there's something wrong with me. Oh my God, I'm bad. I'm failing. And then a huge need to kind of cover over that, you know, get rid of it. I don't want to have that feeling. I don't want to have that pain. And then, so I'll get mad and cover my pain and my shame, or I'll withdraw and shut them out, or I'll do so. So there's, you know, so all this pain often will drive us to do things that are the opposite of love, that involve disconnection. And learning how to love in the face of that pain. So, okay, now suddenly I feel shame. Suddenly I feel like there's something bad, something wrong with me. And what would love have me do in this moment? In the face of that pain, love would have me find out more about what the problem is, find out more about what's hurting my partner, finding out more about what I could do to make them feel better. That's what love would have me do. So in the face of pain, we're constantly having to make choices of love versus coping and avoidance somehow pushing away that pain. And so we come here to learn that. You cannot learn that. You can't learn how to love in the face of pain where there is no pain. And that is why we come here.
Then that deepens the love that we all experience in the afterlife.
Yes, it deepens our capacity for love in the afterlife because we've learned how to do it in the face of obstacles, pain, painful emotions. Physical pain, everything. We've learned how to love in the face of all of that. And we do take that knowledge into the afterlife. And our love is deeper. And it's what makes it deeper is that we see more clearly. We see more clearly what it means to be a soul, what it means to be conscious. Because consciousness has to hold all of that pain, and still find a way to love.
Beautiful.
And that's what Jordan says over and over again. When he talks about love on Earth, and in the book, the one we're talking about now, is, you know, that we have to learn how to love in the face of pain, loss, and impermanence. And also, ultimately, we have to learn to evolve our love so that we're loving all, everything, instead of just our tribe. We need to learn when our emotions, our pain, and our needs all cry out for us to protect ourselves and ignore the other. That's the work that we're engaged in. And he's really very, very clear about that, trying to convey that reason why we're here.
I'd love to hear a few more messages from Jordan in just a moment. Why is this not more natural for more people, do you think? Why does it seem to take a little effort to communicate with our loved ones in the afterlife? Or is it possible that really it's just effortless, but we don't allow ourselves to focus on it?
Well, our belief systems and often our religions don't encourage it. For example, you know, I had a client recently who said, when we talked about, you know, the possibility of communicating to his son who had passed, he said, "Oh no, in my religion, we can only talk to God. We can't talk to the dead. We're not allowed." And he was very, very clear about that. And so I think sometimes that's that our belief systems don't include the idea of being able to talk to the dead or that love extends beyond death. And sometimes that gets in the way for people. I think the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people are looking for the loved one to communicate with us, and they're sort of passive in this. And, you know, it's like they're looking for signs. They're looking for something to show up that says that the loved one is still there and still aware of them. And lots of people do get signs. We got lots of signs when Jordan died. But they think that's the extent of communication. It doesn't occur to them that no, it could be two-way street, that I could engage and I could ask questions and I could express things to my beloved, just as well as they could to me. And I can use words. I don't have to just rely on images, symbols, or events. I could actually use words and they can use words to communicate. So a lot of people just don't actually realize that that's possible. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for something else. They're looking for a sign rather than actual communication. One of the things that Jordan says is that we have to learn how to love everything, the ugly, the deformed. And he says the person with the greatest damage is the one who can teach us the most about love. And so this is part of this thing of loving everything is not just loving the things that are beautiful or the humans or the souls who are beautiful, but it's loving everything, even the most damaged soul, even the most damaged thing, is to be able to appreciate and love what it is.
In your experiences with helping people with trauma, grief, loss, there's this idea that one needs to let go and move on. And by connecting with a past loved one, have you found that that interrupts the person's ability to, for example, if they lose a partner, does that impact their ability to get a new partner? Or in your case, losing your son, with connecting with your son, did that impact relationships you have with maybe your other children or children in general?
Again, it's kind of the opposite. It's, you know, does communicating to those on the other side get in the way of going on with your life? So it's just the opposite. I get to go on with my life with Jordan. And all the ways my life has changed because I have his support and energy. It doesn't prevent me from going on with my life. It enhances my life and supports me to do things that I might never have done or tried to do. So I don't feel like that these communications are blocking the soul on the other side from their work, or blocking us from our work of evolving and growing after having lost physically that loved one. I think it's the opposite. I think the relationships help us grow and continue with the love, and both sides are enhanced. Jordan's life is enhanced because our love is so active. My life is enhanced because I can feel him supporting and guiding me. So it's really the opposite. And what happens when we try to let go of the loved one, say, oh, it's over, their life is over, their love is over, our connection is over, it's truncating our life in some way, because it's denying love that's there. Love that we could have and hold and experience, we're denying it. And so it's actually limiting our life rather than expanding it and allowing us to go on with some new life.
You've received many messages from Jordan, and you touched on this earlier. Could you share, what does he say God or the divine is?
God, from his point of view, didn't always exist. You know, I grew up as Catholic, and the idea is that God always existed and God is perfect. And he says, no, he says, you know, there was always primal energy in the dark, unknown, he talks about, you know, where there's nothing, there's a dark unknown, but primal energy always existed and it was always there waiting. And he describes it as like waiting for a train. You know, the train is eventually going to come, but in the experience of sitting there waiting, it's just the potential for the train. It hasn't arrived yet. The energy of the train hasn't arrived, but there's potential for that. So primal energy is like that. It's energy that hasn't formed into anything yet. It's potential without reality. But that energy ultimately is a source of consciousness. And there's a whole process by which that energy began to turn to light. And then the light began to be conscious. And Jordan says light is the source of consciousness. So as the primal energy shifted and evolved into actually being able to create light, that light ultimately became conscious and became the beginning of God, of the divine. And God wants to evolve. God, the whole point is to grow and evolve and learn. That's what the consciousness is doing. And so God eventually started, you know, the divine started creating smaller units of consciousness to go out and inhabit a universe and learn from that universe and bring all that knowledge back. So, you know, the divine is evolving, growing, learning. It doesn't need praise or devotion. That's completely irrelevant. The divine doesn't need our prayers, where we say, you know, how great the divine is and how much it doesn't need it at all. It's completely irrelevant to the divine. The reason is because we're all the divine. We are all God. So God doesn't need God to praise himself. We're all one consciousness. The other thing that's important, and I think I've said this, is the divine doesn't judge us. No one is cast out. We can't be cast out because we are the divine. So the divine would have to be casting out part of itself. So there is no hell. There's no place where people are judged and humans or souls are judged and cast out. None of that exists. And God just creates environments in which we, as part of God, get to learn and grow, and that God himself grows and evolves. That's what God is. The other thing is that, you know, we often pray to God to fix things for us. And Jordan says that's not really the role of God. God isn't a puppet master pulling strings. God isn't deciding that we're going to get sick, or deciding if we pray enough that he's going to make us well, or that, you know, our football team will win the game if we just pray enough, or that we'll get rain if we just pray enough. God just sets all this in motion and sends souls down to experience it, but is not intervening. God will intervene with guidance. So we can pray for guidance to God or to our loved ones on the other side. We can communicate and ask for guidance, and we can get it. But we can't get like, okay, now I'm going to cure your whatever disease, or I'm going to prevent these people from invading your country.
Our thoughts and collective consciousness has impact, though?
Yes. Collectively, we can impact reality. You know, collective consciousness, we can create a planet. You know, collective consciousness, we can create a universe. I mean, we can create all kinds of stuff collectively. Mm-hmm. But once God sets something in motion and sends, you know, souls down to incarnate, God isn't going to intervene and fix things there. Right. We go down and we have to face whatever the endless sources of cause and effect that impact our life. We have to face and deal with that. And our job is to respond to it, not to get God to intervene to fix it.
What is the nature of the soul? Why do we exist and come here? You've touched on some of that already.
Collective consciousness, God, all divides into units of consciousness that are learning. And they souls learn in the afterlife, in the spirit world. There's all kinds of learning that goes on there. And souls learn in incarnate life. And so God creates souls or divides into smaller units of consciousness just for us to have the experience of learning, of making choices, of failing, of learning from our failures and mistakes. And that's our mission, and that's our work, and that's very sacred. You know, our work is the evolution of our own soul, the growth and development of our own soul. But on another level, it's the growth and development, evolution of God. So that's our purpose. That's why we were created. And you know, one of the things that I think is unfortunate is there are a lot of spiritual traditions like non-duality, which sort of suggests that, you know, a lot of what we're experiencing is illusion. The material world isn't real, and that we're all in these individual dreams. And in fact, our sort of hallucinated aspects of all of God, you know, that's all that this is that we're experiencing. And that's really unfortunate to me, because then there's no purpose to everything we go through. You know, we're having this dream, and we're all alone in the dream, and we're suffering, and there's no point to it. And so what Jordan is really emphasizing, and particularly in this book, is there's a huge point to it. The point is learning and growing and evolving, and that the whole physical universe was created for us to enter as individual souls to learn and evolve and grow in a physical environment. And so there's this sacred mission. It's not it's not purposeless. It's not just some sort of blip on the divine conscious screen of divine consciousness. And so I think what he wants to convey is that there's a profound purpose and reason for our existence, and the physical world exists for the same reason, for us to grow and evolve, and for God to grow and evolve. That's the whole point of it. And it is real in the sense that it's something we all share, and it's also real in the sense that we can learn from each other. If we're all in a in our individual dream or delusion, we couldn't learn from each other. You know, how does a pitcher learn how to pitch? A pitcher learns how to pitch because they're the same laws of energy and physics that apply to a moving ball, wind and spin and release point, all these things. And one pitcher can learn from another because we all are living in the same experience. And we can learn and grow because we share that experience, and we can share our wisdom with each other. And that's why this isn't an illusion. This is a shared experience that exists for one reason, so that we can grow and evolve.
What has he shared with you about predestiny or life plan versus free will?
We're given a number of choices of a possible life. And, you know, Michael Newton in his book, Journey of Souls, when he regresses people to through hypnosis to the life between lives, there is a place where people are shown a number of possible lives and choose among them the one that they're going to. But what they're seeing is potential. You know, this life will be in a certain environment. This body may have certain liabilities or problems. And so they can see a number of different potential things that are likely to happen in that life. Or this life is happening in the middle of World War II, and they're going to be impacted by this huge global conflict. Or one of the people in their family is a real sociopath and is going to do a lot of damage. And they can see some of the outlines of the life. But there's still a lot of free will and free choices that they will make and other people will make in the course of that lifetime. And so as the life progresses, it becomes less and less clear what will happen. You know, so the things that seemed likely when we chose the life many of those things will occur, but some of them, as the life progresses and all these choices get made, may not occur, and very different things will occur. Because we have free will, at least to some extent, we have free will, and our freedom of choice may influence the direction our life changes takes, and take it in a different direction than it potentially would have had.
So it sounds like it's both.
Yeah. And then there's this amazing paradox that Jordan talks about in terms of time. If from the spirit world, we can look at the whole history of the world to the very end, from the beginning to the end, we can see the whole history of the world. However, the paradox is some of those things may change based on, you know, billions of decisions that individual souls make on this planet. You know, for example, you know, how are we going to deal with global warming? Well, that's going to be billions of decisions may ultimately decide, you know, what the future of the planet is. You know, there's the likely future or the future that's possible. And then there's all the changes that could be made as a result of millions and billions of choices. So that destiny exists at the same time it could change.
What has Jordan shared with you about why he left Earth when he did? Because he was very young and he passed in a very tragic way.
Well, he's been very clear that he was expecting to have a short life. And that the purpose of this life for him was very specific. He was recovering from a very difficult past life that had a lot of violence. And he wanted to come and re-enter the earth plane in a situation where there was relatively more support and peace. And it would sort of help him recover from that past life. He was a bootlegger in his most immediate past life before he became Jordan. And it's interesting, and there was bleed over from that life because he was terrified of the police, even as a child, terrified of the police. Bleed over from the past life. So one thing he was getting from this life is a certain amount of recovery and to be able to come to the physical plane and not have violence and have a degree of support and peace. But he was also working on very specific things of being able to use his will and follow through on decisions and make things happen that And he was developing willpower, and he was using this life to do that. And he did. Extraordinary use of his will. And he said that was the main work of this life, which he was then going to take into this next incarnation and use it there. So there was recovery, and there was development of willpower were the main things. And also recovering from fear too, because he was very adventurous. He was very fearful as a child. Again, I think it's from lead over from the past life, but he became extremely adventurous and embracing nature in a very profound way, the beauty of nature. And those are other things he was learning to do in his life. So he had a life purpose or a specific lesson plan, if I could put it that way, for his life. And that's something else that maybe is worth saying is that, you know, when we incarnate, we have on two levels we're working. On one level, we're working to figure out how to love in the face of pain. That's sort of an overarching work of each life. Mm-hmm. But we also have an individual lesson plan that we're working on individual things in terms of development of our soul. And so those are some of the things that were pertinent to his individual lesson.
Are there other loved ones, family members, friends of Jordan's who have been able to communicate with him like you do?
To my knowledge, no one uses channeling. But they have been, he communicates with them in multiple ways. And he has ways of showing up and being present in their lives, and every one of them has experienced him in some way, showing him being present, and you know, even including, I have a dear friend who's been very close to him in the afterlife, who you know, when and she was reading one of his books. He's turning lights on and off in her bedroom to let her know, yeah, I'm here. And so he's found ways to connect and let people know that he's there. But to my knowledge, I'm the one that does the channeling.
Why is it that some spirit souls are able to impact the physical world, like with flashing lights or even sending messages that people can hear auditorially or come into dreams or even apparitions? And a lot of people really want those signs. They want something physical, where others need to go into a meditation to receive them, such as how you have.
Yeah, well, this is what Jordan explains to me. I'll pass it on for what it's worth. You know, there are young souls who've only had a few lives, and then there are old souls, and then there's in between, you know, that have had hundreds of lives. But there are a lot of souls that are just starting out. They're just, you know, and when they start out, they're very vulnerable because they get them in this body, and the body is, you know, it's like the Wild West. You know, it's full of emotions, full of impulses, full of desires. And they have, young souls have a lot of difficulty managing their body and often just get caught in these pleasure pain cycles. Mm-hmm. And also young souls have less control. Their consciousness has less control over things. And so these young souls are, when they're in the afterlife, don't have some of the skills that older souls have. They may not be able to manipulate physical objects. And in fact, it takes a lot of experience of many incarnations and life in the afterlife to be able to manipulate physical objects. It's a lot easier to enter a dream than to influence electricity or something like that. Or it could create impulses. Like, I mean, one time we were at a place, you know, so some having dinner, and there's somebody who's playing guitar, and then he sings this very meaningful song to us. It's something that Jordan used to sing, and very meaningful. And then he says, "I don't know why I sang that, but I had this sudden need to do it." So Jordan was communicating with him. So he was able to enter his consciousness and direct him in some ways. And I think you know, a lot of spirits can enter animal consciousness, and it's not like they are the animal. They can enter the animal consciousness and make it do something a little bit strange or unusual to get your attention and to remind you that they're there. And but some souls are pretty young and have very little skill at this. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends on the skill of the soul and how much they are able to manipulate physical things, or how much they can enter your consciousness through dreams or a consciousness of an animal and so forth. So these skills vary a lot. Mm-hmm.
And some may say we're not meant to interact with those in the other side that much so that we can focus on our lives here. Does that play a role somehow, do you think, with communication that's so overt?
I mean, I think it's possible that we could get so involved with the soul on the other side that we kind of relinquish some of the important things that we're doing in our life. You know, we get obsessed with those communications and somehow lose sight of our work here, about what our individual soul is trying to do here. I don't think that's very common, but it's possible. I will say this, that Jordan has told me that souls are very reluctant and kind of on some level forbidden to predict the future. I mean, they can see the future to some extent, although the future could change, again, because of individual choices and free will. But they can see the likely future, and they're encouraged and almost the level of forbidden to share that future with us. You know, we have to make our own choices. They can support us. They can advise us sometimes. And Jordan does advise me a lot, but they can't say, okay, this is going to happen. You have to do this, or you have, you know, or to avoid this future, you have to do X. They're not going to say that. We're here to learn. And so that would be getting in the way of our learning.
For those who want to be able to communicate with their loved ones, can you share steps in that direction or how you guide people in meditation?
Yeah. So it's actually fairly simple. First of all, you get a notebook, because channel writing, I think, involves writing. And it really helps to physically write your questions and to physically write the answers. It helps with the opening, the communication, but it also helps to deepen your meditative state and your receptivity. Okay, so you get a notebook. It also helps you remember all the things that you learned and experienced in the conversation. I go back and looking at my conversation with Jordan from the past, and it's wonderful because I get to remember things that I'd forgotten. So get a notebook. Number two, get something for eye fixation. A candle is simple. You know, just looking at a flame is great, but you can look at a mandala or, you know, some object, or even if you want, you can look at a picture of your beloved. But candle flame is nice because it kind of holds your attention in a nice way. Second thing is get something that connects you to your beloved, a physical object that they either had, owned, or that they gave you is ideal. Or something that reminds you of them, if you don't have something that they own, something that reminds you of them. I have a person who, with her partner, used to like to walk the beach, and we'd pick up stones together. And then that particular stone, is the object that connects them. So you have eye fixation, you have an object that connects you to the beloved. Now you see if you can get into a comfortable place. I use the same place. Where I'm sitting right now is where I channel with Jordan. So it's a familiar place. It's a comfortable place. So you're trying to create a ritual. The next thing is just a simple breath-based meditation. There are other ways. You can use hypnosis. You can use prayer to open the channel. But the simplest one for me is just a breath-based meditation. So breath-based meditation has three parts. One is you bring your attention down to your diaphragm, down to the center of breath, awareness of your breathing. The second thing is you note your breath. And I just count each out breath. You know, the first out breath is one, the next out breath is two, three, four, up to 10. And then I'll start repeating. So I'm just noting the breath by counting each out breath. And then the third part is when a thought arises, bring your attention back to your breath. That's a breath-based meditation, a focusing meditation. And that helps to get the channel, start to open the channel. And if my mind is sort of chattery, I'll do several rounds of 10 until I feel a certain quietness and an openness and receptivity. But it doesn't have to be that long. It might be 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes a day. But just to have that quietness settle in. Then the next thing is to just bring your awareness to the beloved person. You're about to open the channel. Your intention is to open the channel. And then Ralph taught me to visualize an orb, the color of the sun, just above my head. And now when I visualize it, I can feel something in my scalp. I can actually feel some reciprocal response in my body, in my scalp. Visualize that orb, and then visualize it elongating, turning into a tube, essentially. And that is the channel, and you're opening it all the way to your beloved. It's right at the top of your head now as a channel, a tube that goes all the way to your beloved. And at that moment, you've opened the channel. Just be aware of your love for that soul. Be aware of your love and aware of your intention to communicate, to speak back and forth. Now, having opened the channel, write your first question down in your book, whatever the question is. But it's important to write it down and take the time to write it out. And then wait. And just wait for whatever shows up in your mind, because now your loved one is going to communicate telepathically. wait, just, and the first word that shows up, write it down. And the next word, write it down. And then if there's a period of waiting, just wait. Wait until the next thing arrives, the next word or words or phrase or the finishing of the sentence. And don't worry about what it is. Just write whatever it is. Oftentimes, the first couple of sentences that Jordan writes, I don't really understand where it's going. And if I just wait, eventually it makes sense and it goes somewhere. So what I'm saying is, don't worry if the first words of the sentence doesn't quite compute. Keep the channel open and write the very next thing that shows up. And our minds are not going to be empty. You know, our mind is either you're going to have something that we put in it, or it's going to have something that's being channeled and communicated telepathically. So just wait for the telepathic communication. Wait for whatever shows up and write it down. Something will show up. I have people say to me, well, nothing showed up. I say, that's not possible. Your mind can't be empty. You have to write down what shows up. And just trust that if you write down what shows up, eventually it'll make sense. And the doubts will be there. That's okay. Just write down what shows up. The communication can show up in different ways. It can come as a download, like, you know, this whole knowledge and awareness, no words even, just a knowledge. One time Jordan downloaded an entire psychotherapy to me, which later turned into a book. The entire psychotherapy in the space of, I don't know, 10 seconds, including images, pictures, and all, but no words, the whole thing. And it could be in just like very brief bulleted things, through three or four words, a phrase. So it can be very condensed, or it can be the race, you know, just word after word after word. You can barely keep up with it, you know, this huge volume of language. Or it can show up as pictures, not even language, just images. So what I'm getting at is there are all these different ways that the communication can arise. And just to be open to that, however it arises, go with that.
Thank you for sharing that with us. And what do you say when people are questioning if they're making it up?
Doubts will always be present. I have doubts. Channelers mostly have doubts, I think. But what I say is, does it feel like you're hearing from your beloved? Does it, on an emotional level, does it feel like they're saying things that they would say to you? Are they showing you things that are meaningful to you? And I think that's the test. You know, are the communications, do you have emotional reaction to the communication? That's another thing. Because a lot of times Jordan will say things to me and I'll have emotional reactions to them. And so that tells me that there's something authentic that's going on between us, that he's saying something and I'm responding to it instead of I'm creating the experience. So I guess I just encourage people to do it for a while and see the body of what comes out of it. Mm-hmm. Is what comes out of it good for them? Is it helpful? Does it feel like they're feeling love from the loved one? They're experiencing love from the loved one? Then keep doing it. Those doubts will be there periodically, but it's something that's good for them. And therefore, keep doing it.
Both of my parents went to the spirit world in the last few years here, in the last 3 years. And I had taken a guided imagery training almost 20 years ago now. And in a particular method, it was later revealed to us, because we saw it happen in the class, that people can spontaneously have their past loved ones come to them. So over the years, I've been able to communicate with, like, I've had a few friends die and other loved ones, and I've been able to connect with them. And so I just want to share that it's been very comforting for me to be able to communicate with my parents. And when I connect with them, they're smiling, they seem happy. My dad loved trains, planes, and automobiles. It's like he's gone out and tested every airplane. And that the messages I receive from them are generally very supportive and encouraging of my life.
It's very beautiful, and I'm glad you've been able to create those openings in the curtain so that you can stay connected and keep feeling the love from them.
Yeah. And they let me know that they're waiting for me, that they'll be there for me with the transition. Is that something?
It's very interesting. Jordan says the same thing to me. He promises he will be there for me.
Wow.
Yeah. And I feel teary when I say that. That means a lot to me.
Oh, I'm crying too now. Oh, beautiful. Oh my gosh. Matthew, thank you so much for all that you've shared today. I know you've given a lot for those listening to contemplate. And I want to just briefly read one small passage from your book, because we talk a lot about consciousness and the various aspects of it on New Thinking Aloud. And in your book, in the section, it says, everything changes, but something remains. Yet consciousness never erodes. Our soul, unlike our brain, never forgets. We take with us every lesson, everything we love teaches us, every moment of pain and every struggle teaches us. Each new thing we learn is sown forever into our soul consciousness.
Thank you. That's very much the essence of, I think, what Jordan is trying to say.
And I love that we both got the same messages from our loved ones. So there's some validity there. Matthew, is there anything else you want to share today about after-death communication or any other messages that Jordan has shared with you that you think our viewers would benefit from?
I just want to encourage your viewers to, if they have someone on the other side that they want to connect to do it and not be afraid of it. Just do it, because it will enrich your life. And it will give you support that is not just the support of the living, but the support of those on the other side who love us deeply. And you can even get more than support, you can get guidance. So I just want to encourage anyone who wants to communicate to the other side to do it. And what I laid out is exactly what I do. There's nothing mysterious or special about it.
Because our loved ones on the other side, or seemingly the other side, also want to connect with us.
Yeah. And they're just a thought away.
Matt, thank you so much for all that you've shared today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being with me.
I really appreciate it, Emmy. Thank you so much.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.